This podcast contains adult language and stories of true crime. If you don't like laughing, crying, or being horrified at the actions of other humans, this podcast is not for you.
Welcome to Season 4, Episode 3, Part 2 of Resolved Mysteries Podcast.
Hi.
Hey.
Hey.
Oh, hey.
This is the show where we rewatch, recap, and give you the latest updates to cases featured on the show Unsolved Mysteries. I'm Carlin.
I'm Allison.
I'm Eliza.
So welcome to the show. This is Part 2 of this episode, so go back if you have not listened to Part 1, because
Honey,
there are some great segments in this episode, and they are bonkers.
Yes.
And as you guys know, for every review that we receive, we donate a dollar to a different organization. And for this month, our organization is Life After Hate, which was recommended by our patron, Allison H. If you would like to support us on Patreon, you'll get access to ad-free episodes, 2 additional episodes a month, early access to listener short stacks, and goodies in the mail. Go to patreon.com/resolvedmysteriespodcast. Okay, what are we covering in part 2 today?
All right, I am about to tell you about a holy relic, the Shroud of Turin.
Oh my.
I cannot wait.
And then I finish out the episode with the unexplained death of Ethel Kidd.
Okay.
Here we go.
Here we go.
So, I had never heard of the Shroud of Turin. I never had.
You'd never heard of it at all?
Never.
Oh, wow. I mean, as soon as I saw it, I recognized that face.
Well, yeah, but that face is, you know.
I know.
We'll get into it.
But I've seen it. I've seen it.
But you've seen the face of God? Okay, we gotta watch out.
Oh, no, guys.
Oh, no.
We have to be on our best behavior during this segment.
I'm ready to be on my best behavior.
Okay.
But, like, okay. Okay.
So, for anyone that doesn't know, and if you didn't watch the segment, we should just explain what the Shroud of Turin is quickly. So, the Shroud of Turin is a 14-foot piece of linen that has the likeness of Jesus Christ on it. And the belief is that it is the burial cloth that Jesus was buried in after his crucifixion and when he was put into the tomb. So that's what the Shroud of Turin is. There is, if you look at it, it looks like a man's face for sure on there.
It is a beautiful painting. You're right.
It's undeniably a face.
It's undeniably
very
a face.
Clearly.
There are crossed hands, like, in front of him, like he would have been buried with his hands crossed in front of him. It did suffer from a fire, so there are also burn marks. And there are, like, newer pieces of linen in the shape of triangles that nuns sewed on after the fire to help keep it intact.
Restore it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Stack opens with an interesting point. The face of Jesus Christ has inspired artists throughout the ages, but how did they know what Jesus looked like? And it's true. Like, why do all the Jesus paintings have basically the same face? It's true. They'd all just have sort of the same shaped face, that long hair. You know what we're talking about.
Yeah.
And this is, Stack poses the theory that it may be because of the Shroud of Turin and the face that is on that piece of linen, which looks a lot like what we know to be Jesus Christ, his face, in art, in pop culture.
Stack also called out that the Bible never talks about Jesus' appearance, and I did not even realize that.
No, I didn't either, and that's interesting. So many people believe that it is the actual burial cloth of Jesus Christ. And then, of course, many people do not, or people are wondering or trying to figure out if it is for sure or not. So one of the talking heads is, now it says F.R.
Friar.
Does that mean friar?
I think so.
Friar Tuck?
Yeah. Is that a real Is that a religious figure?
Yeah, I think he's a friar, right?
What's a friar?
What religious affiliation is a friar?
He was Episcopalian, I think. The guy, he did have the,
Oh, did he look like Friar Tuck? Do you have, like, the little brown coat and stuff?
He's wearing, like,
Sorry, it is an abbreviation for father.
Father. He's a priest. They also wear the, whatever the white thing is in front of their throat. Oh, boy.
The collar. Yeah,
thank you. Okay. So, Father Kim Dreisbach Jr. has spent the majority of his career studying the Shroud and is considered an expert. And I love him, even though he believes that this thing is real. And that's fine. That I love him. He seems like a true sweetie to me. Every time he stops talking, he puts a little smile on his face.
Oh,
he's very nice. So he says, when I first began to study the Shroud of Turin, I was convinced it was a crock and it would take me probably less than 2 hours to put away this pious fraud.
I know.
After all, anyone with an IQ 100 or over knows that all relics, by definition, are frauds.
I loved that.
Yeah, I love him. But, he says, I must admit, here I am 17 years later. I, who came to scoff, have stayed to pray. My own personal belief is the Shroud is probably authentic. And then, of course, he ends that with a little smile. He's a honey. So the Shroud was first exhibited publicly in France during the Renaissance period, but no one really seemed to know where it came from. Then in 1578 AD, which we don't say AD in all of that anymore. It's a different way we say time, but I can't remember what it is. The Shroud was moved to Turin, Italy, where it was rarely shown in public. 3 centuries later, in 1898, the Shroud was photographed for the very first time. And Father Dreisbach says that the photographer's negatives showed more detail than could ever be seen by the naked eye when just looking at the piece of linen, which is really interesting.
Oh, yeah.
Wait, I'm sorry, but who originally obtained it? Where did it come from?
Oh, that's okay. The segment says that it was first exhibited publicly in France during the Renaissance. It belonged to a family.
Okay.
And then they sold it, I believe.
But I'm just like, how did this family have it?
Well, isn't it the same family that might have commissioned it?
Yes.
Because it could be the same family that may have also paid to have it made.
So, I mean, any of these things that take place so fucking long ago, who the hell knows about any of it? But
it's all made up.
So the show tells us that it first appeared during the Renaissance. Other history says that it first appeared in 1390 AD when Bishop Pierre d'Arcis wrote a memo where he charged that the Shroud was a forgery. So that's like the first time that we see someone write about the Shroud of Turin. Clearly, it's, like, been around for a while, even before then.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so still kind of a mystery then.
And it's not clear how, but in the Charny or Charny family had the Shroud of Turin. And in 1453, they deeded it to the House of Savoy.
Oh.
Which is like a royal dynasty in the Savoy region in Italy. Yeah. So they deeded it to them. But it's, you know, there's who knows how everyone got a hold of this and all of that. And then apparently this is when it was damaged in the fire in a chapel. The House of Savoy took the Shroud to Turin and it has remained at the Turin Cathedral ever since. So that's where it has been.
Okay. My question is, like, who was like, I found this and the body of Christ has been upon it. Like, who, where did it come from?
Yeah, that we don't really know. Yeah.
People see Jesus in toast and water stains. Come on.
They don't know. They don't know who first found it. So much of it, it's in toast, but why is it in toast? It's in toast because of the Shroud of Turin, because people saw the Shroud of Turin or just have seen that picture in pop culture.
I was just wondering what gave it such weight to begin with for people to even think this is a real thing. That's what I was wondering.
Yeah, I think it's so old that it's hard to know for sure. It's passed from these famous Italian houses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So authenticity because of who they were.
Yeah.
And then just age.
Yeah. But like still 1300 AD is 1300 years after he died. Like, who knows what happened to it in that time if it is the real thing. So Father Dreisbach, who we love, talks about this photographer who took the first pictures of the Shroud of Turin. And he says he was to write of this experience years later and would never forget that as he lifted that glass plate, he believed he was the first person in 2,000 years to have seen the face of Jesus of Nazareth. And it is true. When you look at the negatives of the photograph, you can very clearly see a man's face.
Oh my gosh.
Does that mean that somehow the man's face got imprinted after he died, you know, by blood? I don't know. That seems, he would have to be so bloody. But he did have a crown of thorns, you know, I don't know.
Okay. I mean, that's always been my problem with it, is how clear the face is.
It's very clear. It's almost too clear.
It's very clear.
The alignment is too perfect.
It's too perfect.
It's very perfect.
So Dr. Robert Buckland, who's a forensic pathologist, which we love to see it, and you see him with giant picture negatives of photographic negatives of the Shroud. He's like unrolling them, really explaining things very scientifically, and looking for injuries in the negatives that would be consistent with those of Christ himself. And he says, the body shows a number of injuries. On the head, we see a series of blood stains around the forehead, high in the scalp, and along the posterior portion of the scalp. These are consistent with the application of a crown or a cap of thorns. On the chest area, there's a rather unique wound. It is quite consistent with a puncture-type wound made by an implement which entered the chest cavity and produced an outflow of blood and water. Which I can't remember. I think they probably say this in the Bible that he was stabbed with a big spear. But, you know, you've probably also seen many pictures of that, like paintings of Jesus with a big cut in his side.
Why did
they do that, though? To kill him faster? Or why would they do that?
The Bible says he was stabbed by Longinus on his side to make sure that he was dead.
After he died, they stabbed him.
Oh, to make sure he wasn't bleeding.
That makes sense because they do. It does just like pour out blood, the rest of blood and water from your body where they stab him. But I mean, I think he's supposed to have been up there for like days.
It takes days to crucify somebody. It's a terrible death.
They say in the segment they were doing it 500 times a day.
Yeah.
It's one of the most barbaric things I've ever heard.
So he sees that this body was maybe punctured like Jesus's would have been on the side. And then this is interesting because someone who grew up in the church, there's all this imagery of Jesus with holes in his hands welcoming you to heaven, basically. And the negatives showed puncture wounds in his wrists. Which they explain as that's actually more likely how they would have hung people and someone has then researched that and shown if you drive nails through your hands can't support your weight. So they have to be through the wrists so that those stronger bones on either side of the nail and the muscle can hold the whole body up.
Yeah.
Whoo, mama.
You know,
which do they say, and I think they say in the Bible though that it's through his hands. So where did that get lost in translation, or you know, because that's what like all religious imagery is based on. There are always holes in the hands. So yeah, like you said, the Romans did 500 of these a day. They knew exactly what they were doing. They weren't going to mess. They couldn't mess up this process. And Dreisbach says they were like butchers and they knew where the bones were. They put it in the wrist and it held the body and it held it well. Okay, so after the negatives are taken in the late 1800s, this really sparks a lot of interest in the Shroud of Turin. Obviously, coming into modern times, people are able to actually see pictures of this thing that they've never maybe heard of before, unless you're, you know, in Italy where you could have gone to go see it. And then in 1978, the Shroud was made available to a number of scientists for the first time, and we get to see pictures and video of actual footage of this. So they used tape to stick on the Shroud and lift them up and lift particles up off of the Shroud, being like as careful with it as possible. And biophysicist John Heller and chemist Alan Adler determined that there was blood on the cloth. So instead of it just being paint, they're saying it is for sure blood. Mm-hmm. It says they found chemical evidence of severe torture consistent with crucifixion. I don't know what that means. What is chemical evidence of torture besides blood, which blood could happen without torture?
Yeah.
Yeah.
How does that manifest itself in chemical evidence?
Unless, you know what all those QAnon people say, that we're torturing kids and babies and then drinking their blood because it's got that special thing in it.
Oh, there's a test for that?
There's a special chemical that comes out in blood when you're tortured. Maybe that's what they found.
Oh, okay.
Oh, my God.
Wow. Okay.
Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Science is amazing.
Isn't it amazing? And look at what, you know, look at what these people are doing with science. It's just so beautiful that they put this belief out in the world. We're so thankful for them.
Uh-oh.
Okay. Hey, I can go after QAnon, y'all. Oh, come for me. So some scientists, like Dr. Walter McCrone, who's on the episode, have claimed that, like we're suggesting, that the Shroud is a forgery and the work of a highly skilled artist who painted with tiny, tiny brushstrokes. Which people have said, that's not possible. We would see the brushstrokes. But Leonardo da Vinci was known to paint in a way that you couldn't see small, I almost said blood strokes. Which it's basically that, pretending to be blood strokes. He says, when I first started working on it, I expected it to be authentic, and I looked for body fluid. That's where I started. But the red turned out to be red ochre and another pigment, vermilion, common artist pigments. There's no question in my mind that it is a painting. But our little sweetie, Father Dreisbach, says many copies. This is a good point. He's trying to answer for why paint is found on the Shroud.
Oh, Dreisbach's got answers, honey.
Oh, we love him. He says many copies of the Shroud were made. It was felt by pious people at the time that if you touched the copy to the original, it would give the copy extra sanctity. It's called abandiums, which is the technical name. Hmm. When they were touched, of course some of that pigment ended up on the Shroud. And that is what has been discovered. But it is not responsible for the whole image, let alone the whole body, total front and total back. So
wow.
It's just like when you touch two iPhones and you can share the Wi-Fi.
It's exactly like that.
It's just the holiness.
It's airdrop.
Just goes right in. Mm-hmm. Just need a quick little touch.
Yeah. So, oh boy, then we see some computer technology, honeys. And to this day, I do not understand what the fuck this computer technology is trying to show or prove.
Me neither.
I have no idea.
They showed it like three different times, and I was like, I still don't get what you're doing.
I have no idea what is important about this. So we see optical specialist Kevin Moran, who claimed his computer analysis revealed that the image has unique optical qualities that confirm the Shroud's authenticity. So he puts a normal photograph of a kid down on this like glass thing. And then right on his screen, you immediately see a very distorted figure. The nose and the cheek are distorted. You can tell it's an image. Like, I don't know how to, the only way I can describe it is like it looks like a topographical map, sort of.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And he says the image is made by reflected light. Okay. And he says this same distortion is not what we see in an image of the Shroud. So when he puts the Shroud picture, photograph of the Shroud is in the man's face on this glass, the image immediately comes into a three-dimensional form and you can clearly see the eyes, nose, and mouth. He says,
what is it reading?
What is it saying? And then he says, the image on the shroud is so unique that it almost enters a scientific faith factor all by itself. What does that mean?
What does that mean?
There simply is no way that we can duplicate this image even today, and people have certainly tried. So he does put on, he puts on another picture of a man's painting of trying to copy the Shroud of Turin. And the painting does look different under this reflective photograph technology than the shroud does, but I don't see still what that is saying. He is saying it's proving it's not a painting, but it's just how? The weirdest. Okay.
I'm sure glad they brought him on to explain this to us.
I'm so happy that it was so like much... 7 minutes of the segment and I still don't understand what the purpose was. Yeah, okay.
I was perplexed.
So, in an effort to resolve all the controversies surrounding the shroud, the Vatican allowed samples to be cut from its outer edge in 1988. And they truly take
which
like...
I gasped.
Oh, I couldn't believe. But they're really? Literally like centimeters of linen. Like, they are very small amounts. They show them cutting the big piece, mm-hmm. which is still a small piece, maybe 2 inches. And then I think from that, they gave each university a piece for carbon dating because they unwrapped it out of the tinfoil, which I'm like, yeah. You wrapped this in tinfoil? That's the I best. Know. You're going to throw that out with your lunch. What are you doing?
I know.
It's the weirdest place to put it. But it's like a very tiny piece. So three universities were able to test it for carbon dating, which also, how the fuck does carbon dating work? I have no idea. And I don't think a lot of people do either because they got a lot of different answers for when it came about. So the University of Arizona in the States, of course, placed the shrouds.
I can't get past you claiming that a lot of people don't know how carbon dating works. It's like one of the most reliable things we've used over time.
Well, you'll see. It might not be.
I know.
Oh, gosh.
The University of Arizona placed the shroud's origin between 1290 and 1360 AD, which is when it first kind of comes about in written history, mm-hmm. but obviously would prove that it's not the Shroud of Turin. Mm-hmm. The Shroud of Jesus. I also hate that it's called the Shroud of Turin. Like, call it what you think it is. Don't call it by the place that it resides.
So what would you call it?
Jesus' cloth. Right?
Jesus' sheet.
Okay, fair. Fair enough.
Like, if I heard Shroud of Turin, I'm never going to assume that has anything to do with our Lord and Savior. Jesus no. Christ. Dr. Paul Damon, who works at the university, says, within less than 5 minutes, we could see that it could not possibly be first century. The difference between 14th century and first century is so great that you could see it within minutes in the first measurement.
You're so stupid.
You idiots who don't know anything about carbon dating.
You dumb bitches. I cannot believe you would think that this could be on Jesus's body.
And then he says that he was working with a man who was also doing the carbon dating with him, who was from an Irish Catholic family, again with the Irish. This is an Irish heavy episode.
It sure is.
And the Irish Catholic guy looked despondent when they came up with this date. And he said, are you okay? And he said, I'm just very, very disappointed. He thought it was going to be real.
He yes. had said, I'm surprised about how disappointed I am. Because I uh-huh. thought he didn't really, like, believe in it that much.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then when it didn't work out, it yeah. was like, he was sad.
And if you I mean, hear about it way. Your whole life.
See that? Yeah. Yeah, of course.
Yeah. So the Vatican accepted the results from the University of Arizona, and they call it, they're kind of, the Vatican's known for calling it a relic rather than an icon. And a relic would mean it's, you know, just not, an icon would more be like, this is a true, real thing, proven to be from religious history, and a relic is is a little less important, I guess. But it's still protected widely. It's in like a big glass frame. And people rarely get to, I think maybe you can go and see it, but they did a thing for, I think, Easter of 2019 or 2020 where they were live streaming it for just the day of Easter. And then you cannot see that live stream anymore. You can't see, you can't like click on the website and go to it, which it's like, why? What is the, why not? Oh, another belief. Yeah. So another belief of how it got to where it was that it was taken by the Crusaders, like during the Crusades to Europe. So like they found it and then the Crusade people took it to Europe. Basically, all I could picture was I would be so much more interested in this if it were an Indiana Jones movie.
Yes.
So, okay, y'all, this is just like, you know. Okay.
We're here for you. We're here for you.
So, apparently in 1994, an update to the story aired. Well, we didn't get to see that update. And I don't know what the update is. And I couldn't find it. What is the update?
What could it be?
What could it have been?
Obviously something that was immediately disproven because they pulled it back out.
Because they had to pull it. Yeah, you're right. You're right.
Never mind.
Just kidding.
Apparently carbon dating or historical dating has had some technological advances because actually in 2013, Italian scientists used infrared lighting and spectroscopy to date the shroud between 280 BC and 220 AD.
Wow.
So somewhere in there, Jesus was alive and then dead, and then maybe the shroud was wrapped around his body.
So it could be.
It could be. Oh, yeah. I forgot to say this at the top or in the segment part. The craziest thing that was said was that maybe the imprint, the picture of his body, was because radiation quickly came off of his body during the resurrection.
There was a burst of radiation.
A burst of radiation during the resurrection.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
So they're kind of saying it's not even bloodstains. It's not that. It is radiation that caused this image to imprint on the cloth.
Yeah. I thought that was pretty wild. I've never heard that before.
No.
Wow.
Okay. So then scientists have tested, this is kind of disgusting, pretended to crucify someone, tied them to crosses, poured blood on them where blood would be if you were had a crown of thorns on you and blood coming from your wrists and your side, then laid them on a cloth, wrapped it around them, and no way do they see that any blood pattern would cause this perfect image like we see.
Okay.
So that's another way that people are saying it's not real and it's just a piece of art or a painting. Of course, some people do still believe that it is the burial cloth for Jesus. The forensic anthropologists that did that study are Matteo Barini and chemistry professor Luigi Garlascelli. And yeah, they used a live volunteer and a mannequin to study how blood from Jesus's crucifixion and spear would have flowed onto the burial shroud. Using both human and synthetic blood, they were unable to find a single position in which the blood flowed onto experimental cloths to create the stain pattern on the Shroud of Turin. So, honestly, at this point, I'm ready to go, it's not blood, it is radiation. Because, I mean, I'm not really, but it's got to be a painting or radiation. It's not blood, because there's no way it would make a face and hands. You can see his hands perfectly crossed.
That's exactly it. Even if it was like just the decomp of the body coming off on the cloth, it would be one big blotch where his face was. It wouldn't be facial features.
It would not. It would absolutely not. Oh, I'm so sorry. So the Vatican usually calls the shroud an icon rather than a relic. I had it wrong.
Oh, okay.
So a relic is more like they believe it's the real thing, and an icon is more symbolic importance.
Okay,
without being proven to be historically authentic. Sorry, I had that wrong.
So then I wonder why our buddy was like, I mean, everyone knows relics aren't even real.
Well, because let me tell you about some relics that are out there, Carlin.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean,
we have got Buddha's tooth.
Oh.
We have got baby Jesus's foreskin.
No!
One of the reasons why religions branched off from Catholicism was because of the commoditization of relics. Really wealthy families, it was sort of thought that the more relics you owned, the physically closer you were to God. So the more money you had, the more relics you could buy, the closer you got to God because you had these tangible pieces of religious experience. And I think sort of part of the Protestant branch off was the abolishment of relics and saying that none of these relics matter, none of these are important. But yeah, there's like livers in jars and really weird shit out there.
There's people believe we have John the Baptist's skull, Muhammad's beard or pieces of his beard, footprints. There are like you can see pictures of a footprint of the Prophet Muhammad taken out of dirt. Like they perfectly preserved this piece of dirt that had his footprint in it. All kinds of things. But yeah, baby Jesus's foreskin is one of them, although that might be missing now. And one interesting thing, I did not know that anyone thought that they had this, but the actual crown of thorns that was believed to be placed on Jesus's head is still around, and it was actually saved from the fire at Notre Dame in 2019 by a human chain that brought it and other relics out before this fire collapsed.
Yeah, I feel like I remember hearing about that one.
And you can see pictures of that. It's like in this kind of beautiful, intricate glass or, you know, heavy duty clear plastic wreath. You know, it's like inside of it, so you can see it, but there's gold around it. And they believe that that is the actual crown of thorns, and I had no idea anyone thought we had that around still. Yeah, so, I mean, people still don't know. I think the main belief is that the Shroud of Turin is just, like, an interesting representation of the cloth that would have been wrapped around Jesus, but scientifically, I don't think it's believed to be the real thing, although it was most recently dated to be from his time. I just don't know how that imprint of his body would have been so perfectly made on the shroud.
Totally.
But if you believe in the resurrection of Jesus Christ, then why would you not believe that it imprinted on the cloth? Of course.
Sure.
That's not a stretch if, you know.
The one thing that stood out about it to me, like, if you think about it, if it was just like a piece of art or something, is why was there the print of the backside of him? You know, that to me is very interesting. Like, either it was a piece of art designed to look like a shroud that was around him, or that's an interesting choice.
It is interesting to think about this being the reason why the Jesus that we have in Renaissance paintings and all the way up through pop culture today looks like they all look the same.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Because you're right. Where does that come from?
Where otherwise? Did that come from? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, last thing I have, Reverend or Father Albert Kim Dreisbach passed away in 2006 at the age of 72, and it's really sad. He actually passed away in the airport at Hartsfield-Jackson Airport while preparing to board a flight to Italy to, like, do more work and talk about the shroud.
Oh, my gosh.
I know.
Well, he died doing what he loved.
He really did.
That's true.
He really did. He really loved this thing, and I felt like he was a sweetie. So, okay.
Well, good
That's
job.
It.
That's great.
You know.
Well, we do now.
I mean, we do now. We didn't know much.
Thank you for telling us about Jesus' cloth.
You're welcome. And I would like to now only call it Jesus' cloth from now on.
From henceforth, it shall be known as Jesus' cloth.
As Jesus' cozy sheet.
Jesus is blanky. Binky.
He's binky. He gotta be cozy.
You gotta.
Even Jesus gotta be cozy.
Oh.
Yeah. I mean, look how he dresses. He's all about being cozy.
Oh, God.
He's got sandals and like a little blanket robe.
Flowy. Very Eileen Fisher, honestly.
All right, so the last segment of season 4, episode 3, part 2, is an unexplained death.
And it's pretty horrifying.
You know, this is a really great episode. It really is.
Oh, man.
So the segment begins. Sack tells us that rural Orange County, Virginia is a peaceful landscape ideal for families who want to escape the crime and congestion of Washington, D.C. The community of Burr Hill consists of little more than a post office and a few homes. Ethel Kidd and her husband Gilbert bought a plot of land in Burr Hill, and in 1988 they began building their retirement home. Ethel Kidd was 61 and a grandmother. One of the reasons why they moved to that area was because almost all of her children and grandchildren lived within a mile away. Mm-hmm. Thomas, Ethel's son-in-law, says that Ethel was a good person who was liked by everybody and she enjoyed life. Mm-hmm. On Wednesday, April 12th, 1989, Ethel and Gilbert's house was almost complete, so Ethel was spending a lot of time in Burr Hill. That morning, she visited her daughter, who lived less than a mile away. Ethel returned home and was seen checking her mailbox shortly after 2 p.m. Thomas says that around 7:30 the next morning, his wife called Ethel and got an answering machine. At 9:30 a.m., Thomas drove by and saw Ethel's car there in her driveway. He says he thought something might be wrong, so he went in to check on her. As he's walking across Ethel's yard, he sees an atlas, basically a map book. Remember those?
Oh, yeah.
So he thought Ethel may have dropped it, so he picked it up and carried it in with him. But when he saw the front door unlocked, he knew that something was definitely wrong. So he went into the house and he called for her. Stack says that not only was there no sign of Ethel, but there was no sign of burglary or foul play. With no other leads, authorities assembled a large task force. Law enforcement officials fanned out from Ethel's house and searched the fields acre by acre, but there was no sign of Ethel Kidd. Mm. Also, very different response to a lot of the times when someone goes missing and there's no sign of foul play.
Yes.
Everyone mobilized immediately.
Yeah. Well, because she's not a young
teenage girl.
Woman.
She's not a slut.
Whoring it up.
Exactly. 8 days later, less than 3 miles from home, a hunter discovered Ethel in the same area that had been previously searched the previous week. And then, this is shocking.
Shocking.
They show Ethel tied to a tree. So Ethel Kidd was found bound to a tree in an upright position facing a logging road less than 50 feet away. So she was displayed, essentially.
God.
And I feel like they're, like, upping the ante with the reenactments because in the past, we would have seen, like, a shadowy figure of this.
Yes, absolutely. I agree. It's becoming, like, more scandalous. And I can't help but wonder if the rise in popularity of America's Most Wanted, which their reenactments were very aggressive. Fox. So they were like, show it all.
Yeah.
So I wonder if Unsolved Mysteries was like, all right, we can get in on that as well.
Yeah.
So investigators determined that Ethel had been strangled. They also found evidence of a sexual assault. I later read that along with the sexual assault, she had been sodomized.
Oh, my God.
Okay.
They estimated that she had been dead for around 7 days. Mm. So Sheriff Bill Faulkner of the Orange County, Virginia Sheriff's Department says that the area had been searched by land and by air. He says that she was definitely not at the location earlier in the week. Mm. He says the killer is extremely brazen to bring a body back to where it was kidnapped from and to place it in a position so as to be found near busy roads.
Seriously.
Falconer believes that he may have been taunting the police. Stack says it was clear that Kidd had been kept in cold storage after she was killed. Surprisingly, there were no signs of decomposition. Sheriff Falconer says that the medical examiner stated that she had been kept in an insect-free, climate-controlled condition, which could mean refrigeration, either stationary or mobile, like an ice truck or a walk-in freezer. Other clues soon emerged. Ethel had been bound with a drapery cord that was used in hotels and hospitals, but not available to the general public. Car upholstery fibers were recovered from Ethel's clothes, but the main center of the investigation centered on several items that were tucked inside the road atlas that Thomas had found in her yard.
Oh, yeah. This is so weird.
This case is bizarre. Stack says that the paper is from a national hotel chain, but he doesn't say which one, because he probably was not allowed to.
Yep.
And he says that the notes on the paper contain sexually suggestive messages. One note says, "Let's fuck, pull over," with the word fuck censored out and pixelated, but just barely. Mm-hmm. You clearly know what it says. And then the other one says, "Do you want to?" Oh. Who says romance is dead?
Truly.
If this is like a highway stranger, hot, anonymous sex role play thing between two consenting adults, mm-hmm. like I'm super here for it. But it definitely goes without saying, if you're driving down the highway and a guy puts something like this up in his window, you need to exit immediately.
Can you imagine? Yeah.
Stack then says that the investigators surmised that the notes were flashcards to solicit sex along the interstate. Mm. That is not what I think of when I think of a flashcard.
Yeah.
I'm more of like a math problem, spell this word flashcard girl, and like less of a creepy stranger highway sex girl. But like, admittedly, I've gotten a little soft in my old age. When he said flashcard, I was thinking of vocabulary words and like parts of the cell for science class.
Totally.
So the most chilling evidence was a handwritten list of 7 items that was also found in the atlas. The fact that aggressive stranger sex notes aren't the most chilling things in this murder atlas is pretty alarming.
Mm-hmm.
The list is a, quote, meticulous blueprint for murder. Line 2 listed clothing and accessories, which may have been used for a disguise. Line 3 read, quote, ID ASAP paper trip book. The authorities were aware of a book entitled The Paper Trip, which details how a person can obtain a new identity.
Oh.
Item 4 read, choose location. And item 5 lists the abbreviations HCTPSG. I have the list in full. So number 1 is FA, $40 plus tax, $?. The second one says business dress, shirt, slacks, and then it looks like it says Gracias in parentheses. It's really hard to read. And then cologne, aftershave. Line 3 says ID, ASAP, paper trip. 4 says choose location. 5 says HCTPSG. 6 says glasses, hat, with an arrow pointing to number 3. And then 7 says cosmetics, with an arrow pointing to number 3. Falconer says that the best they can come up with would be HC for handcuffs, TP tape, and then SG surgical gloves or stun gun. He says that this individual is methodical, very particular, and very cunning. He is a loner, white male, probably between 35 and 45 years old.
What?
He has not had, yeah.
I'm shocked by that part.
Yeah. This to me reads like a script for any sort of profile of a sexually motivated killer.
Mm-hmm.
It says he has not had successful relationships mm-hmm. with females. Mm-hmm. He says that they have to assume that this individual travels and stays in motels, which could be consistent with an interstate trucker or salesperson. Stack says that Ethel Kidd was extremely security conscious. Authorities believe that the assailant would have had to devise a clever scheme which would not alarm her. He possibly used the road atlas to make the impression that he was lost. Sheriff Falconer says that this was a very cunning, devious, planned, calculated murder. He believes that based on the murderer's behavior, that he will kill again. Mm. Thomas says that hopefully if he gets put away for doing this, it won't be done to anyone else. He says nobody deserves to die like that. And when I was watching this, I was wondering where other family members were. It was really interesting that it was the son-in-law was the only person talking. So there's an update, and it says that after the broadcast, a tip led authorities to Edward Wayne Beverly, who was serving time in prison for armed robbery. He was identified just months before his scheduled release. Beverly was convicted of the rape and murder of Ethel Kidd and given 3 life sentences, and he died in prison. So that's a lot of updates. So as we do, I'm just going to kind of fill in. Mm-hmm. So a little bit about Ethel Kidd. She was born Ethel Sarah Vogel on May 27th, 1927 in Easton, Maryland, to William Frederick Vogel and Edna Mae Funk. Ethel was one of 6 children. She was married twice, first to Joseph William Allen on November 25th, 1942, and then to Gilbert Madison Kidd on December 19th, 1957. She and Gilbert had 3 children, 1 daughter and 2 sons. So Thomas was married to Joanne Kidd, Ethel's daughter. Thomas and Joanne lived less than a mile from her mother, and the two were very close. Ethel Kidd had 5 children. She had 2 children with her first husband and then 3 children with Gilbert. While Ethel was living in Burr Hill full-time, her husband Gilbert was still working and living in Alexandria, Virginia during the week, which is why she was alone during the week. So this is what I found out about this family. There are a lot of members of the Kidd family. I have a feeling that most of the residents of Burr Hill were members of the Kidd family. So I found a comment on a blog that I guess was written by the wife of one of Ethel's older sons. So she says, and I'm reading a lot of quotes here, so just take it at all face value. Quote, "The media didn't tell you the sheriff was on vacation in Hawaii when Ethel was abducted and that the deputies botched the immediate scene and investigation. They also didn't tell you that Ethel was tied naked to the tree.
Oh.
They didn't tell you that the sheriff was trying to convict Thomas Kidd, her son-in-law, based on the drapery cord alone." So then I was like, what does that mean? So I did research, and at the time that Ethel was murdered and bound to a tree with drapery cord, Thomas Kidd had a job, and it was to hang drapery.
Oh, oh my God.
What are the chances?
So he worked for JCPenney, hanging drapery purchased at JCPenney in people's personal homes. But the drapery cord was only available to hotels and hospitals.
Okay.
But I don't know if the police knew that at the time. So poor Thomas Kidd.
Oh, my God.
Imagine that completely bananas coincidence. Mm-hmm. Of course the police are going to think that you did. Because
It almost looks like a calling card at that point.
Yes.
Like,
and, oh, my God, it's his whole profession. Who hangs drapery? Mm, who does
that?
That's
what I'm saying. Like, it looks so specific.
So then she goes on to say, but Thomas died before Beverly's sister called the new sheriff and had him arrested in Tennessee for the murder. So I read that Thomas died, sadly, in 1994 when he was only 51 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Also, not only was a tip called in, it was Edward Beverly's sister who recognized his handwriting.
Mm. Whoa.
If he had never dropped that atlas, we would have no idea who he was.
Oh, my God. Wow.
Oh, my God. And recognize the handwriting from seeing it on UM?
On UM.
Whoa.
Yep. This woman goes on to say, they also didn't tell you that the cops were also trying to blame Ethel's son, Wayne, and his soon-to-be wife based on one of the papers the notes was written on coming from a hotel/motel in Ohio where her son and soon-to-be daughter-in-law were truck drivers.
Oh, my God!
Members of this family are checking these boxes for local law enforcement.
Yeah.
So, of course, they're going to be suspects. Another person then replied to her, and presumably they were in the sheriff's office at the time. And this person said, quote, "Don't know where you got your information, but it's wrong. Sheriff Faulkner was on a week-long fishing trip at Lake Anna and cut it short when that abduction was reported. I was there when her body was recovered and she was fully clothed. That said, I'm glad Beverly was caught and he deserved to die in prison." Then the woman replies and she says, "I got the information sitting in the house with Thomas, Joanne, and Wayne for 7 days waiting for them to find her and from the actual pictures that Thomas and Gilbert had to look at.
Aww.
Why would they lie about something so horrible?"
Hmm.
So this is like back and forth.
Wow.
And then the last comment came from one of Ethel's grandchildren. Quote, Ethel is my grandmother. I have never heard some of these comments being made. I know it was a horrible week searching for her and going live on the radio begging people to look for her. Mm. She was a wonderful woman who held this family together. The correct man was convicted. He had only God to answer to when he died. My heart hurts daily for what she may have gone through and having to have a closed casket at her funeral and not being able to see her one last time was a nightmare. She was my world, and I miss her so much.
Ugh, horrible.
So like I said, Beverly's own sister, Marcia Williams, recognized his handwriting on the letters that were aired on Unsolved Mysteries. Beverly had lived in Burr Hill at the time of the murder, but shortly left the area after it occurred. He was in prison in Tennessee when he was accused, but fingerprints and DNA linked him to the crime. He was only a few months away from being released from prison until he was convicted in 1989 and charged with 3 life sentences for kidnapping, sodomy, and murder. I read an article and it said, Joanne Kidd, the victim's daughter, said that she will take some measure of peace from the outcome, but it was less than the death sentence that her mother's killer deserved. So, of course, Beverly appealed in 1999. Attorney Roy D. Bradley submitted a 31-page brief to the Virginia Court of Appeals claiming that Beverly was wrongfully convicted. The opening brief called into question the judge's rulings allowing DNA evidence, but excluding blood typing information taken from the same blood sample. So he was basically arguing that blood typing was more accurate than DNA.
Oh, okay. Thanks, bud.
And then Beverly's lawyer also took issue with the judge's denial of his client's request for fingerprint and handwriting experts because the fingerprints are his. There is no discussion. Like, you can't bring in a fingerprint expert that's going to look at fingerprints and be like, no, these aren't his. An expert called by Orange County prosecutor compared Beverly's sample to the DNA from a semen sample taken from Kidd's body. The expert concluded that there was a 1 in 1.7 million chance that Beverly was not the one who assaulted Kidd.
Wow.
Yet, Bradley argued that the blood type found at the scene was type A, whereas Beverly's blood type was type O. I mean, whatever, DNA. There's one out of 1.7 million, but you live in Burr Hill.
Right.
Come on, right. Run the numbers. Beverly's sister testified. Mm. And she said that she could identify the handwriting on a note found near the victim's house as her brother's. And the judge denied the defense request to have a handwriting expert evaluate the note. He also denied a request to hire a fingerprint expert to evaluate the prints on the note, which included Beverly's. So Beverly's sentence stood. He died in prison in late 2008. So then I have a little bit about the experience of shooting the reenactment.
Mm. Okay.
I'm just going to read from an article that I found about it. So this says, an actress selected to portray a 1989 murder victim, Ethel Sarah Kidd, says it was disconcerting to see the effect her striking resemblance to Mrs. Kidd had on the victim's family. Quote, I didn't realize how traumatic it would be for her daughter to see me driving her mother's car until I saw her face, said actress Diana Sow.
I mean, we talk about this all the time. Nobody ever talks about that part.
I know. For her role in the reenactment, Mrs. Sowley had her hair done similar to the way Mrs. Kidd wore hers. She was dressed in blue jeans and a shirt and sweater similar to what the victim wore when she was last seen in her yard and later driving her car. Quote, the way her hair was fixed and everything from the side, she looked exactly like my grandmother, said granddaughter Ginger Hall. It made it hard on everybody. Mm. And the last bit I have is, sadly, Ethel's widower, Gilbert, passed away in 2006 at the age of 71. Her son, Gilbert Jr., died in 2003. And like I said, Thomas also passed away.
Jeez.
I do have to say that her daughters are alive and her granddaughters are alive and they are all still in close contact with each other.
Mm.
But, I mean, if he didn't drop that atlas,
wow,
never would have.
And he would have gotten out and maybe done it again.
Exactly.
Is this really his first murder?
I don't think it is.
No.
I don't think it is. It was so calculated and so played well. He absolutely knew that she was alone during the week. He definitely pretended to need instructions. It felt like he had done this before.
Yeah, and like they said, the brazenness to come back and bring the body back and do that was crazy thing with it.
So that definitely is still very open-ended. I saw like some discussion about that, and there were people who said she could have been overlooked. The evidence of refrigeration was never further discussed. It never came up in the trial. It never came up at all. So people were sort of wondering if he even did that or if she was overlooked. I don't know.
But 7 days is a long time. I know.
And for how close it was, too.
And she was posed by a road. So, yeah, I really wanted to find out about that. If he truly refrigerated her body, then he absolutely has done this before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If he has the presence of mind to mess up time of death and all of this stuff, this is not his first rodeo. But yeah, that came up. And some people were like, search and rescue always acts like they do a good job. One person was like, I was on search and rescue. They miss stuff all of the time.
Yeah.
But I mean, she was very clearly displayed. Yeah. So I can't imagine you not seeing a woman tied to a tree.
Yeah. No.
So
that reenactment was so...
It was alarming.
The only thing was the hands. Because the hands very obviously mannequin hands. They were sticking straight out like this instead of you know.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. Yeah. So that's that.
Sad. Terrible story.
Yeah.
Poor honey, Ethel. Okay. Things to share. Or feel.
I've been listening to Dateline, which I have to be completely honest, I have never watched Dateline. Like, I'm not that type of, like, true crime fan because I think when it became very popular was when I didn't have cable. So I started, like, getting into true crime back in, like, 1998 when what is now Court TV used to have Forensic Files and City Confidential and The Investigators. But so everyone talks about Dateline in our community now, and I don't watch it.
Everyone loves Keith Morrison.
Everyone loves Keith. And I know why now, because I love him. There's like a really like Robert Stack element to him where it's just very dramatic and very, but also very comforting.
Yeah.
So they do a Dateline podcast, which I'm sure everybody knows about. But then they do these like offshoots kind of that they produce. And I just listened to one and it's called Mommy Doomsday, which is a very embarrassing title.
Oh, I've been wanting to listen to that so bad.
It is about, do you guys remember this? Lori Vallow, this woman, honey. Basically she was saying that her kids were fine, but she wouldn't produce them for the court.
It was a saga that was going on for like weeks in the media because she's a psychopath.
We had listeners that were posting about it.
Oh, right. And her husband was a part of it or something, or her boyfriend?
I think she murdered her husband. Both of her ex-husbands? I don't know. It's
her brother.
Her brother murdered
her. No, she murdered her brother, right?
Her brother murdered her ex-husband, and then her other ex-husband, they say, died of natural causes, but they're like, but it doesn't make sense. Sorry.
Yeah.
And then, I guess I can say this because everyone knows now.
Yeah.
But they found her children dead on her boyfriend's property. But there's this whole other religious, like, cult sort of aspect to it where they believed that, you know, what's that called? Where all the bad people stay on the planet, but everyone else goes to heaven.
The rapture?
Yeah. They believed that, like, the rapture was coming, but they were going to stay behind and lead people. And it is, the whole thing is top to bottom. Bananas.
Yeah,
the
doomsday.
And they had gone to Hawaii or something, right?
They went to Hawaii and then and they kept making up stories. They said that the daughter was in college and that the son was staying with his grandmother. Or no, not his grandmother, but an aunt or a friend. And I think the son was on the spectrum, so they said, oh, we had to put him here. You know how, like, challenging it is to deal with him. And
Yeah, but their Hawaii vacation was like amid the investigation.
Oh, yeah. So a judge said, where are your children? And they said, oh, don't worry, they're fine. And the judge said, well, you've got to show me your children because people clearly don't think that they're fine.
Oh, gosh.
And they just left and went to Hawaii. And I need to, like, I feel like if this weren't, I don't know how these people got away with this. Maybe it's that they live in a state that believes in, like, deep religious freedom, even in the face of justice or common sense. I do not know how this couple got away with not producing these children and being able to travel out of state for as long as they did. It's disgusting to me. It really is. And it goes without saying, if this was a couple, an unwed, shacked up couple that were of mixed race, or if they were gay, or if they were people of color, if they were literally anybody, the courts would not have treated them so kindly and given them 6 weeks to produce two children that they said they knew where they were.
Yeah.
It is just so egregious, and it's so infuriating. And I think a lot of mistakes were made. I mean, I'm sure everyone did the best they can, but the legal system is sometimes not great, and they just weren't able to strong-arm these people, or they claim. So it took weeks, months. They were gone for months. And then the judge kept saying, all right, well, the next time you come back, you better have your children with you. And she would say, I will. Oh, absolutely. I'll bring them. And then the next time she wouldn't. So I think it was like 3 times.
Yeah.
Finally, they got a warrant and searched the property, and they found the bodies of these children. So it is a saga. It's bananas.
I need to listen to that. Our friend Spencer Henry over at Cult Leader did like multiple episodes on them.
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
I mean, the whole story is so out there. It's so bizarre, and it's so incredible what people can convince themselves of. It really is. I mean, this woman murdered her children because this man essentially told her that it didn't matter if they were alive or dead. Just what it's the fuck?
Cuckoo bananas.
Yes, absolutely. So that's my recommendation.
I have a podcast as well. It's a New York Times podcast series. It's just 3 episodes, but it's called The Jungle Prince. And it is about this family in India that a mother and 2 adult children who came back to India from Pakistan when India divided into Pakistan and all the Muslims had to go to Pakistan. And they were Muslim, and they came back to India claiming that they were a royal family that had been displaced. And when the Indian government would not give them like anything back that belonged to them, they set up their home in a train station and lived there for 10 years.
What?
Until the Indian government finally gave them something. And it is the story about this New York Times journalist who met, eventually had heard stories about this. She was like a correspondent in India, but had heard stories about this like royal family in the jungle. And it's her story of like discovering sort of what happened to them. And it's so good. I wish it was more than 3 episodes. It's really moving. And as I was looking it up to remember, her name's Ellen Berry. I guess Amazon Prime is like optioning a show about it or something.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, it is really good. I recommend.
Great.
Nice. Yeah.
I'll definitely listen to that.
All right. I wanted to read a few reviews because I love Review Corner. We love Review Corner. So we've had some true sweeties write to us. And, well, not write to us. Write to Apple Podcasts and leave reviews. But we feel like you're writing straight to us, and we appreciate it. This one, the subject line is Love the Nostalgia by Nikki Smalls. My sister and I used to watch this together as kids, and now listening to the girls go back over each episode brings me back to sitting in my living room watching it with my first best friend. Oh, so nice. Okay, then we've got Skunk Bat. This one's especially for you, Allison.
Aw.
Heart emoji, girl power heart emoji. It's refreshing to listen to Three Strong Women, a great accompaniment to the classic Unsolved Mysteries show. Hashtag bury the dick bitches. Hashtag I miss the lisp. Where did your lisp go? You've just learned to work around it, I guess.
Yeah.
And then just one more. Aaron Crass. Honeys. Perfection. Period. No notes. Period. I'm listening to the Edward Casey episode, cry laughing at the part when they describe Casey, quote, getting good at school by sleeping on top of his textbooks. And then the ladies just laugh gently and sadly say, no. Which I don't remember any of, but I love. Okay, what are we talking about next episode?
I have the first segment, and I'm already reading a book about it, so don't worry.
Ooh. Oh, boy.
The topic is The Investigators, which, mm-hmm. have we done that before?
I feel like maybe one other one, right?
Mm-hmm. And the topic is The Connecticut River Killers.
Whoa. Ooh. This is going to be a biggie. Mm-hmm. I have a wanted segment, Judge John Fairbanks.
And we have a Lost Loves about Paul and Paula Scribner.
We love a double Paul and Paula.
We love a Paul and a Paula.
Do you remember that song from like it's like an oldie song where it's like, hey, hey, Paula.
No.
They're just singing back and forth like how much they love each other. And one's named Paul and one's
named
Paula.
That's adorable. Well,
maybe we need to play it for the intro of this segment.
So thanks, honeys. You can leave us a review. We would love for you to do that. Hashtag bury the one stars. You can help support the show by leaving a review. We really appreciate them. And you will also help support the organization that we're donating to this month, which is called Life After Hate. And for every review we receive, we donate $1 to a different organization. And that is our organization for June. So yeah, help us out and help them out. And to see photos we reference in the episode, follow us on Instagram at Resolve Mysteries Podcast, on Facebook and Twitter at Resolve the Pod. You can contact us at resolvemysteriespodcast.com, resolvemysteriespodcast@gmail.com, or at our P.O. Box 14005, Portland, Oregon 97293. Send us your stories for listener short stack episodes, anything you want to tell us. Just make sure that it's easily readable and not just links to articles. Thank you so much. We read so many articles for this show. We would like you to do the work for us.
We're all full up on articles.
But you can email us or send us a letter and we may read it on a listener short stack. And you can support the show by going to patreon.com/resolvemysteriespodcast. And if you subscribe at the $5 a month level or higher, you'll get ad-free episodes, 2 extra episodes a month, and other goodies. And we appreciate your support. All right. We love
you. We love you so.
Thanks for hanging.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Bye. And also, you were not wrong, Allison. It is called a clerical collar or a clergy collar.
You know what? I made that up on the fly, but I stand by it. It makes sense. Are friars like monks? Like, is it another? Is it like?
I mean, there are in Robin Hood.
That's okay. The only time I've heard of a friar.
Okay, listen. A friar is a member of any certain religious orders of men, especially the 4 mendicant orders.
Go no further, my friend.
Augustinians, Carmelites, Dominicans, and Franciscans.
Yeah, but Franciscans are also monks. Are monks different from mm-hmm. friars? Google that, please.
No, when you said earlier, I was going to say a friar is a monk, but I didn't know, so I didn't say it.
But that's true, a friar is a monk. Because Franciscan monks I've heard of, but mm-hmm. not Franciscan friars. Thank you, Friar Carlin.
You're welcome, my sister.
Okay, so, yeah. Okay. Any of this stuff...
Wow, what an aside.
What an aside.
We have, like, four things.
That's the outtake, BTW.